Good afternoon. This is Science is Understanding Creation, number 4. We have two speakers this afternoon. And I'd like to introduce the first speaker, Dylan Ferries, Global Local Explorers of God's Creation. No Wheaton College Nobel Laureate scientist, but some great near misses. This is going to be very interesting.
You can see I forgot what my title was when I did this slide, so... they asked me to fill out what it was, and I said, I forgot what it was. I don't know. 50 years ago, I arrived in Wheaton, and being then one of the older ineligible people for the Dead Scientist Society, I figured that I should tell some people about Wheaton science lore to the extent that I've learned it over the years. First, very easy question for the locals. Who was a college church pastor who went on to become the president. And Charles Blanchard, the son of Jonathan Blanchard, the founder of the school and the obvious, well, not so obviously, the pastor of the church was president of Wheaton College until 1925. Together they were there for 65 years. The harder question, which almost nobody knows around here, is who was a son of college church pastor who goes on to win the Nobel Prize and also become president of a significant scientific university, and that is Robert Andrews Millikan, the Nobel Prize in Physics, president of Caltech. Just on the other side of Blanchard Hall, and I missed it on my thing, so I put an erratum up there. I missed it by a block. Where the place I marked it was where College Church is, but it's one block over there that Silas Millikan lived. And he was pastor from 1864 to 1867. In 1868, early in 1868, Robert was born, but not here. They had moved, so he missed Wheaton by a heartbeat, or he made it by a heartbeat. We really don't know. I assume he was conceived here because there's no other pastor in 1967, and I don't know the dates. I tried to find that out, but I couldn't. Not only did he win the Nobel Prize, but he won it in good company. Einstein in 1921, Niels Bohr in 1922, and Robert Millikan in 1923 for his measurement of the charge of the electron, charge of electricity. I don't know whether I made a mistake or whether they made a mistake. I just now saw that. And measurement of the photoelectric effect. He was seeing these electrons and measuring the charge and therefore the mass, because the mass charge to mass ratio was known, and his work really in some ways gave Einstein the Nobel Prize, because Einstein had theoretically looked at the photoelectric effect, and he worked through this. So, and the electron is this very important particle that we heard about this morning that explains the whole periodic table. So it's really the very, very big game changer in science, which came in the 20th century. This is a picture of the apparatus with the little vaporizer, atomizer on there, where you produce oil drops that are ionized, and you look at them with a telescope, and you can catch them and watch them and save them, something like this guy was talking about this morning. But they are not alone. They are with many others, but it's just a question of whether they jump from one to the other, so you're watching them. His wife was often had to tell guests that Robert was off watching an iron, and they thought he was really quite a domestic to be washing and ironing. Here is a schematic of the photoelectric effect. Photons come in and knock electrons off of metal. And he did a very careful analysis of this, which gave the value of Planck's constant, also a very, very important part of 20th century physics. Let's just jump to a kind of a time frame and look at several things that were going on around 1900. Yerkes Observatory came about in 1897, 30 miles roughly up the road, Lake Geneva. Millikan had joined Michelson at the University of Chicago, who won the Nobel Prize in 1907. Wheaton College was a fairly small place, roughly 75 to 100 at that time, and they had three tracks, and there were only two out of 18 were in the science track. It was roughly a 10% of the school. The other two tracks were literary and classics. Edwin Hubble arrived in 1900, and he's on the map there, and if you walk straight west of here, you will hit Franklin Street and 225 West Franklin Street. The house is still there where he was in 1900 in the census. Another family, set of families, recent mayor Henry Grote and a soon-to-be mayor James Reber. I'm pronouncing them more like we do in English. Those are good German names, so I won't try that. Reber was a trustee of Wheaton College. Both of them were mayors. Their grown children, Hattie Grote, Schuyler Colfax Reber, were married soon thereafter, and they had a son, Grote Reber. We'll see him later. Hattie was famous around town for having seen Hubble's potential. She was a school teacher. Not so clear whether she had him in class, but she claimed he was going to be one of the bright minds. Down in Kansas, a Russian immigrant named Johann Clausen married a Kansas girl from the same immigration movement. Their seventh child was born in 1918, Howard Hubert Clausen. We'll also talk more about him later. In 1908, they finally got a telescope here on campus due to Hermann Fischer Sr., who was professor of German and mathematics. But it was probably too late for Hubble to have even been involved with that telescope. There's a picture of the telescope as seen from right up here just across from the dining hall. It was on the front campus. It was called the Lemon. It was never yellow, but it had the shape, obviously, of that. And I lived just about another block down from that. You could, if you looked through that, you could go down to the other side, just on front campus. Hubble, jumping to 1925, filling in a little bit, Hubble had won a scholarship to the University of Chicago in 1908. His brother had gone to Wheaton College for a year, but he didn't go to Wheaton College at all. He served as an assistant to Millikan as an undergraduate, got a Rhodes Scholarship, came back in 1913, and went to Yerkes and started a career in astronomy, just in time to hear Slipher tell that the nebulae were moving away. He had looked at about 15 or 20 of them and found that most of them were moving away at rapid speeds. There was no way to know what their distances was. And this was a big, big thing, and it set his whole career. 1925 also here, Charles Blanchard was a big fundamentalist. He brought the fundamentals to the trustees, basically a statement of faith. It was had a very moderate statement on creation of man, that is simply that man was a special creation in the image of God. That's all it said. And that eventually became the statement of faith for the college, first printed in the bulletin in 1927. 1925 also, as you know, the monkey trial. William Jennings Bryan won, and 2 weeks later died. And in order to properly honor him, there was a big move to produce a fundamentalist university, and Wheaton wanted to become, maybe, I'm not sure of this, Bryan College and take the money, obviously. Blanchard died also that year, and with him the idea of that. Buswell came in within the next 3 months, and interestingly also Harmon Fisher Sr. died that year, so really a big drop in Wheaton in terms of that. By that time also Wheaton College was a roughly 700 students instead of roughly 100 students by 1925. For the first time, we had PhDs in science on the faculty. This may sound a little funny, but there weren't so many PhDs, and this was also the time of the first full-time Bible teacher, which is very interesting to me. Milliken was already has won the Nobel Prize and is Caltech president. To mention another couple of old-timers from around here, Russ Mixter and Paul Wright would have been students at that time, and for you locals who knew Chaplain Welsh, he would have been as well. A student, I think, graduated in maybe graduated in 25. Certainly within a couple of years of that. Hubble's work, he was really changed the view of the universe. The universe expanded by billions in terms of volume in his by his findings, and it also showed the expansion of the universe, which of course harks back to the creation of the Big Bang. And not only was it a large, much larger thing, but it was a change from a static universe to a dynamic universe. He lobbied for his Nobel Prize, but astronomy didn't get Nobel Prizes, and even with a public relations hire, he was not able to get it. In fact, he did get a couple of nominations, which was interesting. Here's a couple, some pictures of Hubble as a athlete at the University of Chicago on the basketball team, and here with the telescope at Mount Wilson. His public relations coup was the Hubble telescope, which he had nothing to do with. He had died for many years ago, but that's obviously the way we know his name. Everybody knows his name. And there is a Hubble Middle School still here, but nobody would know him because of that.
Is there still? And I don't mean to be.
You may be right. I've been away from here for a while.
I think it's a grocery store now.
I know that one is a grocery store, but still out at in Warrenville.
I didn't realize that.
The moving, I think. I'm not sure because I've been away for a few years.
No, but that's good.
That's good. Okay, we had another astronomer. Did I say okay? Another astronomer who opened the view in a different way in the frequencies. He was a radio engineer. He was the son of Hattie Grote Reber, the grandson of a trustee of Wheaton College, the grandson of two mayors. Both of his grandfathers were mayor of Wheaton. Found that there was radio waves coming from outside the solar system in 1933. Grote Reber heard about this. He was immediately attracted to go to Bell Labs, where Jansky was. They wouldn't hire him, so he built his home with his own money, with his own hands, in his backyard, or side yard, I think is what they call it. There's a picture of him in 1937, and here's a picture of his telescope, which is also marked on the map. It's not there anymore. It's been moved to West Virginia as a kind of a museum piece. This is 30 feet across, so it's quite a jungle gem for your backyard. Here he came back in 1988, and there he's a picture of him up there and him with the physics department at that time, or at least some of us from the physics department. He also didn't get a Nobel Prize, but he really opened astronomy to get Nobel Prizes in astronomy because within 10, 20 years, in the 1950s, Penzias and Wilson, following up on his work, found background radiation and got the Nobel Prize in 1978. And then later, in 2000, Smoot and Mather, finding the anisotropy of the background radiation, also got the Nobel Prize. And I think there are several other Nobel Prizes in that area.
Perlmutter.
Saul Perlmutter. Yeah, and so here he was a Wheaton native, born and raised. He did this amazing work. His telescope was moved. I think he helped them move it. Then he moved to Tasmania for not greener pastures, but quieter skies and more room to do his radio astronomy, where he stayed to his death in 2002. And here you've seen this picture as well. This is the latest of the radio astronomy results in 2019, a black hole seen in radio frequencies. Jump to the 1960s. The creation-evolution question, which had arisen in the fundamentals but was not a very big thing, came with back with a vengeance, with Darwin's centennial coming in 1959, Morris Whitcomb flood geology book coming out at about the same time, Walt Hearn, one of our dear ones, speaking here at Wheaton College in the early 60s and causing a tremendous stir. They always tell you how much money, and I don't know what it was. Lost millions of dollars because of all this stuff. And anyway, the footnote. They added a footnote to the statement of faith, which you guys kind of heard from Provost Diddums. It's scary stuff, whatever. I haven't been around, and so I don't know what she's up to, but she got up and read that thing to us, essentially. And it was really like a witch hunt in the 1960s.
What was it again?
This was Age of the Earth, wasn't it?
It's basically creation versus the question of man as the literal Adam, the direct creation, not the age. It doesn't have that, but it has several wordings in there that are really kind of hard to parse, and she didn't try to parse them. She had an absolutely non-nuanced statement about it. Everybody signed, except I found out after I wrote this down that there was one trustee who would not sign it. His name was Stanley Olson, and some of you old-timers in the ASA may know Stanley very well. I never knew him, but he was a very interesting, important character. Howard Clawson and Stan Parmeter left the faculty in protest, not of the statement of faith, but in protest to the faculty treatment, the attitudes of the trustees to the treatment. Okay, and so here is Howard working at Argonne. He got 6 nominations to the Nobel Prize. We always heard these rumors that he had been nominated for the Nobel Prize, but we never knew for sure until this was released in the last few years. And good names up there, Nobel Prize winners in his nominations. Here's a picture from a little booklet of the things that they found, xenon compounds, which was what, and there's a picture of him. You can tell he's a chemist because he has a lab coat on. You can tell he's a physicist because it's clean. This is what they did. Very, very simple idea. You weigh the container, you put the ingredients in there, you cook the thing, you suck the gas, you cool it so that it would condense. Anything that was formed in it would condense. You suck the gas out and weigh it again and see if there's anything in there. And there was, and it matched. So it was a great classic experiment. It was done in 1962. You may have noticed the dates of the other things were 64, 65. It may seem like these things, which were inert, would not have so much energy, but yes, you got to worry about chemical energies are chemical energies. And so here is a nickel container which was ruptured by an explosion of xenon trioxide. He came back to Wheaton College in the early 1970s. One of his greatest contributions was the conception, the planning, and giving the seed money for the HNGR program in the early 70s, and it's still a very important program here at the college. He retired in 1980, moved out to Oregon, built himself a Seth's Holler home, as Grote Reber had done in Tasmania. I don't think Grote Reber ever finished his Tasmanian solar home, and then moved up to Seattle.
Was he a member of ASA?
Oh, yes. He was on the, whatever you call it, the executive council at one point. And, yeah, he was at the last meeting that was at here. They didn't ever get it right, but he was here. They didn't even get that we had a meeting here earlier. Okay, anyway, don't say anything but good about the dead. And with Howard Clausen, that's easy. And here is my attempt at a tribute to Howard. You probably don't recognize this building, but this is this building from the other side over there. And you can maybe read that. I can read it from up here. If you can't read it, there. I wish. Anyway, thanks, Howard. I went to Oregon to visit you, but you'd already gone. I went to Russia, but I didn't even know your father had been born in Russia. So I didn't find him, obviously. And may all God's dead scientists rest in peace. And the rest of it, the next three or four, are on the handout that I've given there of the contributions of these people. ASA wants this to be scholarly and up to date. They've been dead too long for me to be more up to date on it. And how can I be scholarly? I'm not trying to be scholarly, but there are some wonderful references. A couple of biographies, a couple of local publications about local history here. And very interestingly, to any of you who are interested in following this at all, not only Howard's book on the noble gases, but down here he wrote a letter to the Board of Trustees, which I have a copy of, and I can tell you how to get it other than giving you one myself. And Kenneth Geiser also wrote a copy of a letter to Billy Graham about this issue in those same that same era. And there was one other thing. The ideas for this fundamentalist university was published in this 1926 of them. Charles Blanchard sent an article to them a few days before he died in December of 1925. And this was published there, and it's the idea for this fundamentalist university, which would honor both Blanchard, as other people saw it, and William Jennings Bryan. So, thank you.
Yeah, we'd like to think that scientists continue their research on the other side in glory. Physicians would be out of a job. Any questions?
Yes, Kurt. Just want to make a brief comment. I had one class from Howard Clausen here, and he was a tough professor. But one thing I remember is he said he never prayed about the outcome of his scientific experiments because he was afraid God would mess it up for him.
He was always asking me questions about, do you think you could you could do an experiment about prayer and ask God, you know, this problem of testing God. Yeah, he was very interesting with a lot of wonderful things. Yeah, Steve.
I hate it when people make comments and not ask a question, but sorry. Geology here at Wheaton, there's no Nobel Prize in geology because it's not a science. You know? But there are many awards in geology, and there are a slew.
You have some wonderful people, and yes,
that went. But many of them were actually chemistry majors.
What?
Many of those
were chemistry majors.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, one who was a geologist was a geochemist. Mm-hmm. He was part of the Apollo program, and there's a geochemistry award in his name. His name is Paul Gast. So, I mean, it's really interesting.
Can you name a couple of the others? Of course,
Wally Broker, who just died, was, has every award you can get other than the Nobel, but he's the grandfather of global warming.
And of course, I didn't mention John Wesley Powell, which gives a very interesting connection here that it was Wesleyan Methodists that that founded this place, and so it was not an accident that John Wesley Powell, I don't think called John Wesley Powell, called Wesley Powell, or Wes, was named Wesley. But he went to Wheaton before it was Wheaton, when it was still the Methodist school.
The Illinois Institute,
just for a year or so. Yeah. Larry?
There's one story that apparently you had never heard. Neil Grace used to tell this story about Howard Claussen. Actually, Neil Bartlett was involved in the first xenon compound, but they involved platinum and fluorine. So the group
Argonne.
The group that Howard was part of.
Yeah. Neil Bartlett was not part of that group.
That's right. He was in British Columbia.
Yeah.
But the group at Argonne was told by Howard, the chemist that he was working with, that they ought to be able to make the compounds, you know, binary compounds by direct reaction between xenon and fluorine, before Bartlett even reported this.
Okay.
And it wasn't until Bartlett was successful that the chemists at Argonne were willing to try what Howard was telling them to do.
Okay.
Grace used to tell me that story,
and I
wasn't sure it was true, and I never asked Howard about it, but I did discover an article to that effect in Angewandte Chemie that was telling that same story. So it's in the literature that's exactly what happened.
And an interesting thing about it also was that after the fact, they found that just bright sunlight with xenon and fluorine was enough to produce it,
right.
But you have to do it under really special conditions because water, any water vapor in the air, you have to have it really dry. So,
right.
And I never really understood why you have to have nickel containers, but that's what they did. And obviously, this picture was not in a nickel container, so I don't quite know all of it. I don't know much chemistry, obviously. Yes?
I've read that Millikan, even after his experiment to verify Einstein's interpretation of the photoelectric effect, Millikan was still skeptical of Einstein's interpretation.
Absolutely.
And I haven't read his Nobel address, but I'm wondering if you have any information on how long it took him to really come to
it. I don't know, but there are two things about that I do know. One is the Nobel Prize, the Nobel lecture. He definitely states that. And then he's more than skeptical. He said, this does not give you reason to believe that Einstein's model or this idea of a photon. He did not believe in a photon when he wrote his Nobel lecture. The thing that really bugs you, though, after the fact, and one of the reasons that I said this about you, it's not so easy to keep quiet about the bad things sometimes. Later in life, he changed the story and made it, how he had basically proved the photon. So, it's really not so nice.
I read a comment by Elio Sangre, his book From X-Rays to Quarks, about Millikan. And he said, he comments a little bit on Millikan's Christians and Physics, and that he was quite a promoter, though, and that the joke was there was some kind of crusade going on. I think it was at Caltech, and there was a big sign campus that said Jesus saves, and someone made the comment, but Millikan takes the credit. You can read Segre to get the
well credit. I don't want to get into Millikan too much, but I wrote about a 5,000 word chapter that biography is quite open about his very difficult situation.
Thank you, Dylan.